In the coming week, it's finally here. The pitting U.S. presidential election pitting incumbent President Donald Trump against former Vice President Joe Biden. It's October 29th, 2020, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Well, it is safe to say there's no bigger event happening around the planet next week than the U.S. presidential elections. So we are dedicating this entire episode to the November 3rd vote. On this podcast, we're going to talk, of course, about the consequences internationally, as well as the extraordinary activities on the day itself and those days following. The results will carry enormous ramifications for Americans and for the rest of the world as well. Jim, as the marathon election season nears its end, can you walk us through what's at stake in the results?
Certainly, Bob. If you listen to the partisans on both sides of the debate here in the United States, everything is at stake. Heard plenty of prominent Republicans talking about how socialism will take over the United States if the Democrats win. And you hear plenty of Democrats talking about how America's constitutional democracy is at stake if President Trump wins. And I got to tell you, Bob, Americans are certainly voting like something is at stake. As of this morning, 78 million Americans have already cast their ballots. That's about 50% of all the ballots cast back in 2016. Indeed, this could be the first election in U.S. history when more people have voted before Election Day than on it. And as we're looking at this early voting, the mail-in voting, we're seeing voter turnout at rates we haven't seen in more than half a century, and possibly even more than in a century. You think back to 2016, Hillary Clinton against Donald Trump. Turnout was about 55% of the voting age public. In 2008, when you had the big race between Barack Obama and John McCain, voter turnout was about 57%. And that was the highest since 1968, which was the last U.S. presidential election where at least 60% of the voting age public turned out to vote.
And a year, by the way, that this year has been compared to in some respects for the domestic upheaval.
Certainly is, Bob. And the fact is, it is conceivable that we could get close to that number or perhaps even exceed it. Now, as we go into next Tuesday, most of the talk is about the presidency, and that's for understandable reasons. Presidents have outsized impact on U.S. politics and society. I think the presidency of Donald Trump has shown that to be true. It's very clear that Donald Trump and Joe Biden have very different visions for America. In some ways, they're alternative visions. So whoever wins will be making big choices on things like taxes, healthcare, climate change, inequality, systemic racism, relations with American allies. The list goes on for quite a while. But I think it's important to note that next Tuesday's vote isn't just about who is going to sit in the Oval Office. It's also about who will control Congress. Democrats almost certainly will keep control of the United States House. They may even increase the size of their majority there. The big question on Capitol Hill is whether Republicans are going to keep control of the Senate. Whether they do or not will have massive ramifications. Just imagine what a Biden presidency would look like if he confronted a Republican Senate, or what a Trump second term would look like if he faced a Congress in which both houses were controlled by Democrats.
And I would just say to confirm, Jim, that it's every House seat is up for grabs and something like 35 Senate seats are being contested?
Correct. Every 2 years, every House seat is up for re-election and roughly one-third of the U.S. Senate seats are up. Now, of course, we tend to spend a lot of our time talking about what's happening here in Washington, D.C., but this is a big election that goes well beyond federal offices. Most states are having elections for governors and state legislatures, and these votes have outsized importance in a year like this one because it's an election year that ends in zero. That is, this is the year where we elect the state legislatures and state governors who are going to be the ones that determine reapportionment of the United States House, how congressional districts will be redrawn. Again, baked into the Constitution, we do this every 10 years. If you go back 10 years, Democrats took a shellacking in 2010 up and down the ticket. Republicans gained control of a significant number of state legislatures, and those state legislatures turned around and drew gerrymandered congressional districts that maximized the number of Republican seats in the U.S. House. So you can think of election results in any year ending in zero as sort of the gift that keeps on giving if your party wins big. So I think there's a lot at stake up and down the ticket in next Tuesday's vote.
You know, as we walk through the issues at stake, you can't get away from issue number one, regardless of how different the two parties seem to feel about it, which is the coronavirus and the response. It is going through a major wave hitting the United States as well as most of Europe at this point, and in varying ways, other parts of the world, Jim. Although the countries that are entering their springtime seem to be faring a little bit better. But could you talk a little bit, Jim, about just sort of what the election could mean for a U.S. response and whether that response has international implications?
Well, Donald Trump and Joe Biden have laid out very different visions on this issue, like most other issues. If you follow President Trump on the campaign trail doing his stump speeches, his argument is that the virus is behind us. We're turning the corner and we've got to reopen the economy. He's taken great credit for the fact that the numbers for the third quarter were just reported, set all-time records, but they set all-time records, of course, because we set an all-time record in the plunge of the U.S. economy in the second quarter. So President Trump, in some sense, is saying the virus is going to run its course. And what we rely on is hopefully we will get vaccines that will come fast enough that we'll be able to put a dent in the virus. Then we will also get therapeutics, that is strategies and medicines that will help the country adapt and help people who have been diagnosed with COVID-19. If you look at Joe Biden, he's argued that the pandemic, in essence, is job one, that the United States needs to get it under control before we can get the economy fully rebounded. And so he has laid out a large-scale policy that relies on getting people to wear masks to socially distance, as well as investing in the same kinds of vaccines and therapeutics that the Trump administration has championed. Obviously, for a Biden presidency, what we would anticipate is a lot more attention and investment in public health to find strategies to, again, try to isolate and contain the virus.
It seems like the public health policy aspect is sort of a knife-edge point, perhaps beyond the rhetoric, the way in which the federal government would, let's say, embrace or take on the advice of experts to guide policy seems to be sharply different between President Trump and former Vice President Biden, Jim.
Well, it certainly does, Bob. And again, they just have very different worldviews. And it's not just on the issue of the pandemic. It goes across a whole slate of issues. I will note that if Joe Biden succeeds in winning next week and becomes president of the United States, he's going to have a very big challenge trying to enact the plan or the strategy he has for the pandemic. One obstacle he's going to face immediately is that the institutions of public health in the country, certainly at the federal level, have really suffered over the last several months. We're seeing talent leaving these organizations, but at the same time, trust the public has in these institutions to deliver has gone way down. They have become sort of caught up in the political ferment and fervor that we have had. And that takes you to the issue of a vaccine. If you do get a vaccine, the question is going to be, can you persuade enough Americans to actually take the vaccine? Again, that's assuming that you can get production levels up to be able to distribute it to a wide portion of the country. And again, the vaccine and the pandemic debate, like almost every other issue in American politics, has become intensely politicized. And it's not too hard to imagine that even if we get a vaccine, that it may be very hard to persuade substantial numbers of Americans to take it.
Now, aside from the coronavirus response, the speed in which a vaccine can be laid out and so forth, regardless, there's going to be an economic impact caused by the speed in which the U.S. sets in motion a response. The two candidates differ, but maybe not as much as some people might think in terms of their worldview on sort of getting U.S. on a healthy trading platform again. We're in a moment now, though, where you're seeing what might be a sharp difference, Jim, in terms of how the different candidates would view the World Trade Organization. We're at the cusp of choosing between two candidates, one from South Korea, one from Nigeria. And the Trump administration seems to have cast its lot behind the South Korean candidate, while many other countries seem to be supporting the Nigerian candidate. Part of this is also about how the U.S. regards the WTO and regards rules-based trading, global trading system on a whole. This is, I guess, my way of walking into the trade issue and how the two candidates would cast their different policies policies in that respect.
We'll do, Bob, but I want to go back and revisit something at the beginning of your conversation. I want to emphasize the pandemic has already done great harm to the American economy, and it has intensified income inequality and wealth inequality in the United States. And we've talked about this before in the podcast, but the pandemic has had a disproportionate effect on working class people, hourly wage earners. Again, if you're in the hotel industry, the restaurant industry, work in the airline industry, you have been really hard hit by the pandemic, hit in a way that a lot of white-collar workers, people who work on computers, information economy type people haven't been hurt.
And that's people who tend to have better health plans as well to kind of support them through something like this.
You're exactly right. A lot of these things overlap, and it's been made all the worse by the failure of Congress and the president to be able to put together another relief package for the American public, for the people who are really hurting. And it's very likely that we won't see another relief package for weeks or months, if at all. So again, there are big economic issues percolating around here that I don't want to sort of shuffle off to the side, even though I do think the trade issue is important. You're quite right that on trade, Donald Trump and Joe Biden are in the same time zone, at least rhetorically, though not necessarily in the same zip code. I will note that Joe Biden has made it clear in the campaign that he's not about to do any trade deals until he can make a down payment on an investment in the American people, in American workers. And he's laid out a number of steps of what he wants to do. So I wouldn't sort of assume that because Joe Biden wins the presidency, if that's what happens next Tuesday, that we'll sort of revert to trade policy as it existed in 2016. And again, I think politics is likely to reinforce that point with the Biden team, because the American public is really focused on help us get through the pandemic, help us recover the jobs that have been lost. And again, beyond that, there's a long laundry list of pressing domestic issues. And again, if you look at public opinion polls, people are voting based on their concerns about domestic issues, not voting based on their concerns about what is happening overseas. And I don't think that's going to change. Moreover, I think it's important to look at and confront the domestic constituencies for Joe Biden. You know, if Biden wins next Tuesday, it's going to be because Democrats have come together convinced that they need to have somebody other than Donald Trump in the White House. But that doesn't mean the Democrats are united on the issues, or maybe a better way to put it, how fast to go with certain policies. And again, I think you see the so-called progressive wing of the Democratic Party, think of Elizabeth Warren, think about Bernie Sanders, much more hostile to traditional U.S. trade policy. And I would expect they will be pressing to see U.S. trade policy change significantly. So there's that sort of aspect to keep in mind. So I don't expect to see a Biden presidency all of a sudden turn, let's say, and begin negotiating trade deals with anyone. They're going to have big questions they're going to have to answer on the trade front. One, I think you alluded to, with the World Trade Organization, which is, how are we going to deal with it going forward? The Trump administration has refused to allow anyone to be appointed to the appellate body of the WTO, which effectively limits its ability to perform its main function, which is to adjudicate trade rules. Big question we're going to see is, what does the Biden administration do to reinvigorate the WTO? I think that's their inclination, but I haven't really seen a well thought out plan as to how they're going to do that. The other thing, obviously, and here's a difference with the Trump administration, I would expect a Biden team to want to keep up pressure on China, but to try to do it by working with American allies who have many of the same objections and concern about Chinese behavior.
I guess I would just add to that, Jim, that the WTO issue is similar to the way the Trump administration approaches other international bodies, which is this narrative, general narrative of the U.S. has been played for saps, you know, pick your issue, pick your trade agreement, pick your world body. We're not going to put up with this anymore. We're going to stick up for our rights and for our prerogatives. And it seems like when you see the polling, which is showing sort of nationwide a sort of solid, steady lead for Biden, but also a very steady core support for Trump, as it has been through his first term, of people who say he's doing just what he said he would do. He's fighting for us. He's fighting for American jobs. And whether or not you agree with the track record, or you look at the track record closely and find major faults, it seems like that has also resonated with candidate Biden, who's talking about manufacturing and keeping jobs in America as well.
Oh, certainly. In that sense, politics is a bit about learning lessons from those who've won and taking them and applying them to your situation. I think quite clearly, Joe Biden has played up the guy from the hardscrabble town of Scranton who understands what working people are going through and is committed to delivering, he would argue, what Donald Trump promised but failed to deliver. But let's sort of shift ahead, Bob. We talked a little bit about the windup. What should we be expecting on Election Day?
Well, Jim, you mentioned at the outset this extraordinary number of people who voted ahead of time, 78 million or so already, sure to be record numbers overall turning out. And that's not to say there won't be lines on Election Day itself. And given the requirements for safely voting, there's going to be social distancing rules in effect. There have been some places, some very large facilities set up, athletic arenas and so forth, to help accommodate bigger numbers of people. But as we're seeing already in the pre-voting that's been happening in states, Jim, lines will still persist and sometimes lines that last the entire day. So I think we should all expect to see images and video footage of lines stretching around city blocks and rural communities and so forth for both parties, I think. But especially the Republicans, I think, there's expectations that people are going to be turning up on the day itself to show up.
Bob, can I ask you about that? Why is it that we so often have long lines at polls in the United States? We pride ourselves in being a democracy, being the oldest democracy or oldest continuous democracy in the world, yet voting is such a hassle.
It sure is, Jim. There are so many reasons. I think, again, just on the November 3rd front, it'll be exacerbated by the requirements related to voting under COVID. But also, it has restricted the number of places where voting can take place. But even pre-pandemic, access to voting and the smoothness and the ease of voting have been a real problem and a mounting problem in the United States, especially compared to its Democratic peers around the world. The line issue, I think, is a matter of facilities, infrastructure, proving people's identity, all sorts of different things that have not been handled as smoothly across the board. Some precincts do it well. There's some people you hear about, I went in, it was great, it was easy, but in too many places, and it must be said, in too many places in where you have, say, more disadvantaged people, poor minorities, and so forth, it's a tougher road to hoe.
Do you think that's intentional? I mean, is that part of voter suppression, or is that just the way things go?
My response to that, Jim, would be there are certainly a number of people, including many in the civil rights community, who are challenging various moves throughout the country who would say that's very much in fact and that it's a Republican-led effort. Republicans would dismiss that and say whatever steps they're taking are about ensuring transparency and proper voting credentials and so forth. But it is a problem. It is among the many problems this country has in terms of creating a safe and smooth voting process. Aside from the lines, I would just say, Jim, that the lines and the access, there's also things like, you know, the U.S. doesn't make it easy in terms of the day of the week. It's a work day. People have to take time off, go before, after, lunch break, whatever, and set aside time to vote. And in countries like Australia, which has very high levels, it's actually mandatory. You actually face a fine if you don't vote. Many other countries do it on weekends. We talk a lot in our podcast about upcoming elections. They are almost always on like a Sunday, a day in which people are free to be able to turn up and vote. And yet that's not the case in the United States. And so on top of that, problems related to apathy in terms of information, you know, another issue we've talked about a lot, I think, sort of growing news deserts. It's hard for people to find out what's going on and how consequential their votes may or may not be. Some rarely charged issues do get a turnout. I think one of the hopes for this upcoming election, Jim, is the fact that given the stakes involved and the high level of interest that can be sustained and that can create a pattern of voting and a pattern of civic involvement that'll maybe make that situation better and take care of things like some of the voting infrastructure problems we've had in this country. I think there are other issues that the country has to reach a consensus on, which is mail-in voting. And then finally, I would say something we've touched on before, but which bears repeating, which is there's no nationally run voting system in the United States. It is 50 states and the District of Columbia. It is a state-run affair, and states vary in their approaches. And some states are well-oiled machines, and some, by comparison, are, you know, old clunkers. So everything that's kind of running into this incredible storm of a 2020 election season, and it's what adds to the drama, I think, that's going to be playing out during the day of November 3rd.
Well, I'll note, Bob, that I voted by mail-in ballot for the first time in my life this electoral season, and it was actually quite simple and straightforward, and I was quite impressed with it. But I want to ask you about a related issue when we're talking about people going to do in-person voting next Tuesday, and that's voter intimidation. There has been a lot of talk about it this electoral season, certainly more than I can remember in past years. I know that some of that has been spurred because President Trump has talked a lot about votes not being watched, and he's calling people to come out to the polls and have poll watchers. And this has particularly been pretty heated in Philadelphia, I believe the district attorney of Philadelphia is fired back at the president. This is sort of the modern way of doing things. A lot of this takes place over Twitter. But how much should we be worried about voter intimidation next Tuesday?
Well, that's another compelling subplot and a kind of thing that we rarely talk about in recent memory in U.S. elections, Jim. We've had some pieces on our website about it. Foreign Affairs has published some pieces this week on this as well as a so-called militarization at the polls. And this gets to a number of issues involving, first of all, the growing number of kind of these unofficial militias across the country. A number of them support President Trump. President Trump openly embraces their support. He said famously at his first debate with Joe Biden, when asked about the Proud Boys, to stand back and stand by. Later, his aides sort of stressed that that just meant that they need to not get involved in intimidation or anything else. But there's a lot of skepticism about that. There was a plot to kidnap the governor of Michigan. And while the president has pointed to his own administration's role in uncovering that plot, there's been a lot of skepticism about that because he's going out to rallies where people are yelling, "Lock her up," in relation to Governor Whitmer. And he has not moved to stamp down that. Again, he's been very supportive of these groups that are openly supportive of him, which has raised a lot of concern that if there are voting areas that are seen as overtly Democratic or places where people are expected to vote for Joe Biden, there might just be some armed groups walking around sort of intimidating or making that voting process a little bit more fraught. Now, I should be clear, there's a couple of situations going on in the country in terms of state constitutions prohibit unorganized militias. It's a clear matter of state law. However, a number of them have open carry laws that allow people to take their weapons, including into polling places. That and the degree to which law enforcement will step in to enforce orders by governors, let's say a Democratic governor orders law enforcement to patrol rather heavily at a polling place and the law enforcement is disinclined to do that, you're starting to see some of the divides this country has nationally playing out in those scenarios. And it worries a lot of people. I'll add one more thing on that, Jim, which is some of the events this past summer in response to the federal response, especially to the protests that erupted after the killing of George Floyd about systemic racism. Some of the protests spilled over into violence, spilled over into looting. And in Washington, D.C., the president called for National Guard forces. A number of states complied, and there were National Guard forces in Washington, D.C. There were federal DHS agents in places like Portland, Oregon. And so you had at the behest of the president, forces beyond the police patrolling, and people are worried that the president might see fit to call out such forces if things got testy on election day.
I'm curious, Bob, how do you see social media playing into this? Obviously, Facebook and Twitter took a lot of heat for 2016. They've tried to change how they handle some things. That's created a whole new series of criticism. But certainly on election day, we're going to be hearing a lot of stuff through social media, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, the rest. How do you see that playing out? Is that going to make things go more smoothly, or should we worry that it's going to inflame things?
Well, you need look no further than some of the testimony that took place just this week in the Senate, Jim, where you had the chiefs of Twitter, Facebook, and Google addressing senators and sort of facing partisan complaints, Republicans complaining that free speech was being suppressed on these platforms, Democrats complaining that too much was being allowed. And that sort of points out how much and how controversial these platforms have been, because at the end of the day, according to many surveys now, an increasing number of people, increasing number of Americans are getting their information. Information and their gossip and going into their echo chambers on social media. And this is one of the things I think that really differentiates 2020 from previous years. I think you've had a lot of historians, pointing out that through the years, divisiveness and rancor and so forth have not been alien to American polling places or to American election days. However, social media's ability to knit together like-minded groups and especially armed like-minded groups really worries officials. You add to that trolling by, let's say, a foreign actor like Russia, in which they invent, certain scenarios that might provoke armed groups to turn up at a polling station. Antifa is raising a ruckus at such and such precinct, and you get 20 armed guys who go down there to respond. I'm exaggerating a little bit, Jim, but basically it's this type of thing that has already been pointed to by federal U.S. officials as a concern and as something that is intended on stirring divisiveness and sort of further eroding and weakening the American democracy at its most vulnerable, crucial moment.
Yeah, I must say that's what I worry about, that you're going to have isolated incidents that then get inflamed on social media and they become much bigger and they matter not just where they're happening, but their spillover effect. So maybe people decide not to go and vote because they're afraid of it happening at their local polling place. And indeed, nothing may happen and you just have rumors, false rumors, sort of ginned up on social media because what's the old saying, you know, falsehoods make it all the way around the world before truth gets its sneakers on or something like that. You really worry about how this could play out. And again, if this is a close election, as many people anticipate it being, this could be a real problem.
It's that atmosphere and it's, you know, whether it's the so-called fake news or fake developments and then hot takes on that. And then, you know, it's sort of the whole misinformation circle feeding on itself. That is a real concern. And it's, you know, everybody's armed with smartphones and the latest devices that will bring that, all that information to you at a moment's notice while you're waiting online to vote or whatever. Again, the country is at a really vulnerable point. It has pulled together during other election cycles. We did see, actually, there was a great deal of bracing for instability and hacking and so forth in the 2018 midterm elections. And that didn't happen. There were some events, but it went off largely successfully. But this time around, again, everything is antagonized by the COVID situation. And by the way, the lockdowns that have been ordered by governors, especially Democratic governors, has really riled up groups that sort of these unofficial militias in particular, and have also created tweets and provocative language from President Trump that has only added to this sense of frustration and spilling over. Some of which I think also added to the hard feelings that spilled out after the George Floyd killing, Jim. So the country, again, is you know, sort of alarmingly combustible. It's also exhausted, I think, by the 18 months of this campaign and by the sheer volume of information and harsh language. And I think one other thing we should probably add, Jim, is probably the record-setting amount of money spent on this campaign in terms of pure campaigning, in terms of ads that go out on social media and go out on other media, well into the billions, all of which adds to this saturation and this really pitting of you know, evil against right doers, and the zero sum aspect of this voting is all adding up to a rough day. I am going to be interested, back to one of your original points, though. I am going to be interested to see, in addition to the presidential race, how things shake out in the Senate, in Congress, in the state houses, and also in some of these voter initiatives. There are about 20 ballot initiatives in different states, Jim, about police reform that are a direct result of some of the things that we saw this year in connection with the George Floyd killing. Basically, it's just a big exercise in U.S. democracy, and how much will it kind of hold together?
Bob, I just want to touch briefly on one point you raised, which is the potential for cyber hacks. Now, I think this is a theoretical problem, could become a real problem, and it could cause significant disruption on election day if, for example, somehow computer access in a state to voter registrations all of a sudden disappeared. You can have a variety of scenarios coming up, which could make it impossible for people to vote. And again, it's sort of hard to sort of game how that would play out, but that's sort of that wild card out there that could really change the course of the conversation. And of course, then there's, even if nothing happens, you can get conspiracy theories that things were hacked and the rest, and that can create its own set of problems. I don't think we need to dwell on it, but I just want to point out that while we like to think we have good confidence in the security of the elections, there's always the possibility we could discover we weren't as good as we thought we were.
No, it's a really good point, Jim. I think cyber experts will say that, you know, the U.S. retains, you know, strong offensive capabilities on cyber and strong overall capabilities, and that the federal government can work with the big tech giants to thwart major attacks. But again, it's in this environment that we're in right now, it still raises concerns about, you know, what could happen underneath the radar. We just saw in the last couple of days some ransomware attacks on some major U.S. hospital networks that cause real problems. That's alarming for a number of reasons. I think one of them is just the kind of disturbing aspect of, in the middle of a spike in coronavirus cases, that someone would go after, you know, hospital to do this kind of thing, you know, speaks to the, frankly, depravity involved. And, you know, what else are some of these capable hackers, you know, willing to do? I think that raises concerns as well that go to the actual election result, but even beyond that. So, Jim, we get through the election day, and then it's on to the counting. Some states can begin counting ballots before November 3rd. Others can't. And this might mean that we may not have a clear winner on election night. Those who are familiar with the drill would know that the Associated Press is sort of in the lead on calling elections. AP is already laying out its parameters for when it would feel comfortable in calling a race. It's got a new system set up. It used to be set up on exit polling, and since there were so many votes ahead of the election day itself, they're just sort of calibrating it differently. But Jim, what is your sense? When might we know the results of the election?
None of us know, Bob. It's all going to be determined by what happens next Tuesday. I'll point out three things, Bob. First, not knowing on election night who is won is not unusual or unprecedented. I'll just note that many people went to bed in 2016 not knowing whether Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump had won. And of course, you can go all the way back to 2000, which really isn't that long ago, in which we didn't find out who won the election until December 12th. Second thing I would say is, while there's been a lot of talk about how we may not know for days or weeks, it is quite conceivable that we will know on election night who has won, or at least have a good idea who has won. In that regard, I would suggest that people pay attention to what is happening in Florida. Florida polls close in most parts of the state by 7 p.m. They'll close in the panhandle by 8 p.m. Florida projects to begin reporting its votes by 8:30 p.m. And here's what's very interesting about Florida. Florida has a lot of experience with early and mail-in voting. In some sense, it's modernized its procedures. And Florida, unlike, let's say, Pennsylvania, begins validating ballots before Election Day. So Florida anticipates reporting all its early voting and previously tabulated mail ballots by 8:30 p.m. Now, if those early numbers make it look like Biden is likely to win in Florida, then Donald Trump's chances of winning in the Electoral College take a decided turn for the worse. And again, there are a number of other states that are very close right now that will begin reporting early in the evening. Think North Carolina, think Georgia, which polling show is very tight. And if in fact votes break toward Biden, then it's going to be very hard to see what President Trump's path is to re-election. So that's one possibility. Now, of course, if President Trump holds servant in those states, and again, those states I just mentioned are ones that he won in 2016, or at least it's unclear who has won in those states, then I think everyone's eyes are going to turn to the battleground states in the upper Midwest, namely Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. These are, of course, the three states that were part of the blue wall that were punctured or broken through by Trump back in 2016. He won those three states by less than 78,000 votes combined. And here's what's interesting about those states. Those three states only start validating and counting ballots on Election Day. I should point out, counting ballots is generally pretty easy, right? Many of them are machine read, so you feed them in, you get the numbers. It's the validation process that can take a long time. So it is conceivable, let's say in Pennsylvania, that they won't really be well into their count until next Friday. So again, if it has happened that we really, you know, have a lot of close races, a lot of things are up in the air, it could be by the end of the week. Then, of course, you can get arguments if it's really close, lawsuits start getting filed. And that gets to our third point. The counting of these votes could drag out for a very long time as litigation takes place. That is, we could sort of get election 2000 just in several states, played for much higher stakes. And then you can get into the really dystopian outcomes where sort of the results are disputed and the whole election gets shifted to Congress, which we can talk about. It's pretty complicated. It's also not that likely. And maybe we can save our discussion of those obscure parts of the U.S. Constitution and U.S. electoral law for when and if we ever face it.
We could just say maybe generally there is a broader timetable that is involved, I believe under federal law, requiring counting to end by a certain date, requiring a certification, requiring electoral votes to be officially cast and so forth, all of which is supposed to provide enough time to set up a clear transition by Inauguration Day, which is January 20th.
Exactly right. And it's pretty detailed. And there are a lot of complicating or complex factors in it. I will note that on two occasions in American history, 1800 and 1824, the election did go to Congress. It could conceivably happen again. And if you think we've seen partisan wrangling to this point, I can only imagine what the partisan wrangling would be if the election ended up being decided in Congress. I should be specific here. If the election shifted to Capitol Hill, the House would be choosing the president, the Senate would be choosing the vice president, So depending upon the control or distribution of party seats in both chambers, you could conceivably have one chamber elect a Republican and the other elect a Democrat, not out of the realm of possibility. One other thing I would note in terms of the House vote, should we ever get to that point, the vote in the House would not be by individual members. It would be by state delegation. So what that means is, number one, D.C., which has a say in the election of the president electoral college, would have no say in this scenario because the District of Columbia has no seats in the U.S. House, no voting seats. And in terms of state delegations, each state would cast a vote. So presumably each state would cast a vote depending upon the allocation of party seats in its delegations. So if a state is majority Democrat, you would imagine they would vote for Biden. If a state's congressional delegation is majority Republican, you would imagine they would vote for Donald Trump. Now, I will note that in this scenario, that currently Republicans control more state delegations, 26, than do Democrats. But it would be the new or incoming House that would actually do it. And we don't know what that distribution would be. And if you want really dystopian outcomes, imagine that it gets kicked to Capitol Hill and state delegations in the House are split evenly, 25-25 or 24-24 in two states where you have equal numbers of Democrats and Republicans. That's when things start getting really interesting. And I'll just say, for people who are really interested in these long shot possibilities, go to lawfareblog.com. There's a series of articles written by a law professor named Scott Anderson, which explores these scenarios in tremendous depth and are very interesting, though I think, again, I want to emphasize here, we are very unlikely to get there.
I think even without those scenarios, Jim, we're in for another massive civics lesson. The world is, actually. So hold on and read your Lawfare and the other astute constitutional writers, and we'll take it from there. I would note also that on CFR.org, we have a special election site, Election 2020, that covers a whole panoply of international ramifications of this election and the intersection on domestic issues and national security issues. Jim's had a number of great discussions on the President's Inbox, our podcast on issues of relevance to the U.S. place in the world and to whatever the inbox facing the next or continuing president. And we have a tracker that looks at 14 important foreign policy topics and how President Trump and former Vice President Biden have and would address these issues. So lots to go through, lots to parse through. And as I said, hold on.
And I just want to say, for anyone listening to us who is eligible to vote in the U.S. election next week, if you haven't done so, I hope you would do so and don't take any of what we've discussed today as our effort to try to dissuade you from exercising
Absolutely.
What I see as your civic duty.
And that's our special look at the world next week through the lens of the U.S. elections. Here are some other elections and major votes to keep an eye on. Myanmar is set to hold its second general election since the end of military rule in 2011. Ivory Coast and Moldova hold presidential elections, and Algeria votes on constitutional reforms.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also did double duty as a recording engineer. Special thanks go out to Anna Shortridge, Cara Jackson, and Kendall Ross for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and be safe out there.